This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
It is 7 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're still listening to Power Talk with me, Eldrin Simpier. So for the next 53 minutes, we'll be focusing on unpacking the implications of South Africa becoming a welfare state. The question that I have is, are we not already a welfare state? But what are some of the characteristics of a welfare state? So we'll be in conversation with the SACP's first Deputy General Secretary, that's Soli Mabaila, who's joining us on the line. We're also joined by economist Xanti Pai. And the suggestion that came from the SACP in that the 350 rand, you know, the social relief of distress grant, the 350 rand, the SACP saying that it must be converted into a universal basic income grant. And remember that this conversation has been ongoing even now during COVID-19. So you convert that into a basic income grant. But when you convert that into a basic income grant, that it's, does it still remain at 350? Then comes another question about people becoming dependent on the state. Is there fear at all that people will become dependent on the state if there is a basic universal grant? Because the other thing that you need to take into consideration is that you have the child support grant that starts from zero all the way until the kid reaches 18. What happens after that? So what we could term that missing middle. Because the only other time that they'll qualify for grant is when they qualify for pension. But in between, this person is alive, this person is breathing, this is a warm body, and this warm body forms part of our social schema as well as the society, which is highly, highly unequal. So what does this mean then for SA? 0861-987-000. You can also tweet at Eldrin Simpier, hashtag PowerTalk, and also tweet at PowerFM987. But Mabaila, good morning and welcome to PowerTalk.
Good morning, Adrian, and good morning to our listeners.
Xanti, should I also say Sabona Babu Xanti Pai?
Good morning, Aldrin.
Morning and welcome. But Mabaila, let's start off with you. How should we characterize the idea of a welfare state?
Well, a welfare state essentially is a state that looks after the well-being of its people, guaranteeing the foundational basis of the right to life. And the consequences of the right to life, for instance, the right to food, the right to shelter. So normally people talk about concept of food security, but you'll talk it from a point of right, as well as the right to education. All the foundations that will make an individual become independent, being guaranteed by the state in order for the individual to fulfill their obligations in society and also for their lives. So in that way, you can characterize that as the welfare state.
So you say that so that they become independent, because what people would say when they speak about a welfare state is that the citizens become dependent on the state. But you are arguing that no, actually, it is for them to become independent.
Yeah, it's the foundation to guarantee their independence. Mm-hmm. For instance, if people are properly educated, given appropriate skills, they don't come back to the state. In fact, later on, the state will leave on them in order to give others who are coming through those who have become independent and are contributing to the well-being of the state itself. And then they are able to continue to roll out the same process that they did with the previous ones. So it's not necessarily, as it's been denigrated in some quarters, to create an impression that these people, they do nothing except to live on the state. Yeah. It's because, for instance, some of them have no ability to live by themselves, that the state has to come in. For instance, many people, in your introduction, you raise a very fundamental point that if you look at the people that get assisted either at school, when they pass school and let's say they pass matric and or even get a first degree, but are not employed, and they remain unemployed, having nothing, and if they never get employed, like what is now happening to many of our young people, they will then get a form of a grant or assistance by the state later on in their late life. So they've not been able to find time to contribute immensely, given when they still had the energy to the well-being of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So this guarantee creates possibilities also for the people to contribute to the well-being of the state. That is why, if you remember in the movement here, when we're introducing the whole concept of public service, community service by a public service, those who have been assisted by government, particularly the medical doctors, and we've been saying that should have expanded beyond the medical doctors who for instance, will spend a year in a public hospital before they can go independent. So the system in many countries, particularly Scandinavian countries of welfareism, has been utilized to complete the whole cycle of solidarity in a society, with this public purse or the state at the center of coordinating that solidarity process.
Okay. Santi, do you agree with that characterization?
I absolutely agree with it. And I think that Mr. Bayle is very correct to say, and in the way that we have thought about it generally, when the phrase is used in South Africa, it is really actually with a denigrating tone.
Mm.
And it's quite something different to what some people will call a nanny state or something quite different to that. But the implication, of course, is he actually says that there's a part of it that speaks directly to the issue of solidarity. So as a society, we look up at each other and we say, look, while we can, there are some people, for example, without the means to have an education independently, if government did not itself participate in funding education. By that we mean, therefore, the taxes of ordinary people. And I think sometimes this is the thing that, we know that, ordinary South Africans wake up every day to go to work. They pay their taxes, whether it's through VAT, through fuel taxes and levies and all of this. So in a sense, so that they support each other. Where I think has been the main thing, and exactly in the description that Mr. Mabale is using, is that unfortunately, because of the quality of the services that we provide, then people are not able to be independent. And you can see that really in the level of grants. In that, what you then have is a situation in which where we are giving the support, for example, in a working health system so that you can then continue to be a strong person and be able to work for yourself, or the education system that allows you to either access work or to be an independent entrepreneur. All of these services themselves do not actually turn the situation around. And we note it in the number of people that continuously, if you look at the graph just of the grants that we provide to people, have been increasing consistently since 1990, I think 1996 when we started providing this. And so the problem is that you want that to actually turn around so that actually it is to support the weaker rather than to support an increasing number of people who, because our the welfare that is being provided is not actually appropriate, it's not making the difference. So the education system itself is not producing what you want, whether in both primary and tertiary education, but also to intervene in areas where when the government has been able to give you the education, that the economic structure, because remember, a welfare state is not just about the social a part of the economy of the society. It is also about the economic structure and the economic foundations on which actually build such a society. So you don't want a situation in which you provide, the social services, but the infrastructure and administration that the government provides in making sure, for example, that the power dynamic between the citizens themselves. Remember, what we are trying to do is really to provide a base on which citizens are able to be independent and to work for themselves. And we have an economic system, unfortunately, that actually, for the most part, actually prevents the independence of people to be able to self-provide, because the system itself is rigged in a particular way. And I think you use the word inequality, and that's only just one part of it.
Yeah, yeah. So does it then mean that when we have this conversation around the welfare state or South Africa becoming a welfare state, that we should start pinpointing what is wrong with the economy? Because right now you have, for instance, universities churning out graduates, but then the graduates don't find jobs.
Exactly. So the welfare state actually protects and promotes both social well-being and economic well-being of its citizens. So you can't be a situation in which you say, well, you know, we've provided the social services, mm-hmm. whether it's health, education, but the economic services themselves are not in such a space. So, for example, what are the things that prevent people in an economic environment, for example, to start their own businesses, whether it is in issues of, you know, sectors of production, financing, access to markets, all the things that allow a person to be an independent person that contributes to society and almost pays over, I wouldn't say pay back, but pays over the social solidarity, right? Because actually what society has been even able to give me, to empower me, I should be able to pay that over the solidarity that we are in together. But the problem is, therefore, is that it becomes, as you say, the dependence, the welfare dependence, rather than actually being able to be ultimately independent. Yep. And that really does have a huge part in the way, in terms of the way our economy is set up. Many people will say, I'm not able to find a decent job. I'm not able to find a decent work. I'm not able to run a business because the structure themselves, I mean, we can talk about the anti-competitive behavior that we've seen. You know, the cost of goods and services for people to be able one day to be able to buy a house, to, you know, to build a house for themselves. All of those things are actually part of a working welfare state that actually can then, you know, whether it's a transport system that allows people one day to be independent, so you can't be a worker of a certain type and without progressing into better. So I think that is a very important conversation, because then in that situation, you're able then to ask yourself, are we then able to provide that in a way that actually works? And what are the things, what are the impediments that stand in front of that? And I think that's the discussion we haven't had. I think good and well that we all agree on the welfare state, but whether or not actually what are the impediments that stand in front of that so that we can resolve that situation.
Okay, and what would those impediments be, Bob Mobile?
Well,
currently.
Let me appreciate the introduction and input by Kanti, because some of the impediments he has raised them is the structure of our economy. Our economy, the South African economy, was created largely to cater for Europe and the white minority in South Africa, not the majority. The majority were used as a cheap labor to fulfill what was required in Europe, whether it was in the production of minerals that were used to industrialize Europe. Now, when we have a democratic dispensation, the intervention into the economic sphere has been too slow, so much that the economy is still structured in an export-oriented way. That is why, for instance, you still have a massive underdevelopment in the country, and we have we still produce a lot of good products, and we send them abroad, when actually we could have remodeled the economy based on the needs of the people here at home. Whether it's the development of roads, proper infrastructure, roads, housing, schools, appropriate schools. I mean, we continue to complain about the nature of our schools, particularly in the rural areas or even the townships, the level of inequalities that must be tackled. But to have a tangent to deal with these inequalities, you have to unleash the capacity of the economy. To do so, you need a significant control of the economy by the state. And that is why we've always fought against privatization of state entities, including what we currently have in our hands of SOEs, where some neoliberal who are addicted to just having a particular budget for a year and lose the instrument, and because they think they can go and hire the instrument at a higher cost. We want those institutions. That's why in the past we used to call them the commanding side of the economy. Whether it's your telecommunication sector and so forth. So when you have got those institutions in your hands as a state, you are then able to direct the prioritization on the areas of intervention, because you have got all the research about poor areas and what needs to be done and so forth. You are able to provide a legislative framework and compliance enforcement. But in our case, I think this has been, the capital has literally been too independent and actually been controlling, if you like, a government. Government has been too weakened by the capacity of capital, even by collusion with capital, mm-hmm. largely because of the tender system that we used, which has now, as we know, created its own problems.
Because, Tlandi, for me, what some people, I think, miss when it comes to capitalism is its ability to, to reinvent itself, you know, continuously, and making sure that it still has its hook on the levers of economic power.
Yes, look, I think that sometimes we also, I sometimes hate using these words like capitalism and socialism because they misdirect actually what we aim to say. So it's easy to say capitalism, but I think sometimes when you think about it, the forms of it, in some instances, where actually you mean that, you know, you mean not so much capitalism, but maybe power and strength. In a democratic society like ours, you want, when people come into this society of laws, that it is actually through the law that we actually engage each other, not through might. And one of the things that have happened is that we now have, you know, the power of, you know, big corporation, the power of the rich, that can actually use itself to actually to undermine the efforts of the poor. And that is actually the problem that we face. And that government actually, in the office, is supposed to actually make sure that we are all actually governed under the same law, that nobody, because you are much more powerful, are able to undermine the poor. It's almost like, you know, the same things why we don't, you know, get property by conquest. We don't actually force people to do things because we are, you know, you are stronger. We don't use, in the labor sector, for example, the powerful can then have people being exploited and working as if they were slaves. So we ended all of those things and said, look, let's work with the law rather than working with power, such as issues that will leave us to slavery. What the problem then has been is to say, all of these laws that we have that allow us to do that are actually not being implemented properly, and some of the problems. So if we think about it very clearly and simply, a lot of people, for example, would like to do better in terms of being able to build houses and participate in the construction of infrastructure in South Africa. And that is actually a way of inclusion, whether it's energy infrastructure. People want to be able to farm and then be able to sell their farm produce, to store it and to sell it in the market. But we know that, you know, the big corporations are able to actually keep them out through, you know, actually economic bullying, I'd like to call it. So one of those things, and so we set up something like the economic, the Competition Commission. Where then it fails is in where it actually mets out the punishment for people who actually behave badly. So to say, look, we're going to stop you. People have to go to jail. Remember, it's also about incentives. What are the incentives that our legal system gives, or disincentives for certain actions in society, so that actually it does not actually collide with the interest of the majority? And I think one of the things that happened is that, as many people, if somebody does, is engaged in anti-competitive behavior where they keep out smaller retailers illegally, they have anti-competitive behavior, which means actually smaller township players, small agricultural players are kept out and therefore cannot themselves, you know, grow and provide employment area. That is, then the government has to do something. And that has been really weak. It's been a slap on the wrist. And therefore, these are the kind of examples that we can give to say, look, you can't speak of a welfare state in areas where now we find ourselves discussing not so much actually how do we promote the welfare of people, but actually what is the least we can do, which is then the universal income grant, because it speaks directly to this idea that, you know, we have to help people minimum because actually they have no other way to eat except by which the government can give them something to keep them alive. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, is that then the solution is not the solution you want, that actually will, you know, we are now trying to find a way of how we can keep people alive rather than how people are able to prosper, participate, and actually help others who may need that help.
Okay, 061-987-000. There's something that you just mentioned, Tlandi, but we'll raise that just after Power News headlines. In the meantime, you're taking your calls on 061-987-000. Your tweets at Aldrin St. Pierre, hashtag Power Talk, and also you can tweet at PowerFM987. Sean, good morning.
Morning, Algin. Love this conversation. Really awesome. And I think this is the failings of radio and why podcasts succeed. We need 4 hours for this, literally, to actually unpack it all and to really give it justice. You know, I think there's two things you need to remember with capitalism. I was actually having this conversation with someone the other day. Just two facts. The first fact is, if slavery was legalized tomorrow, the stock market would break every record. The second fact you need to remember about capitalism or corporate is that there are such things as child labor laws. they actually had to make laws to stop companies from exploiting children. And if those laws disappear tomorrow, you can already hear the marketing campaigns. Let children have a choice over their future. You know, that kind of rubbish. But I think there's things that we can do to address this. One, like I've always said, there should always have been a TRC for big business at the end of apartheid. And still not too late. We can still have one now. Because once again, these are the companies that propped up and funded the apartheid government, but also profited off essentially slave labor for generations, and they never said sorry, they never paid any money back, and they never dealt with inequality. And the only way they did is by making Cyril and Tokyo billionaires. That's their trade-off. The second option that we have is to change what it means to be a company. And then we don't have to deal with this inequality. Like I said before, the standard model now is a company is responsible to shareholders. That's why I can give the middle finger to society and everybody while still smiling. So what we need to do is say that you're responsible to your employees first, your community second, and then your shareholders third. If we had to do something as simple like that, companies would not have the ability to inflict this gross inequality we're facing. Just to sum it up, there are CEOs that earn 150,000 Rand plus in a day. Between 8 a.m. and 5 a.m., they have earned 150,000 Rand. That is more than your average black worker will earn in a year, some in 2 years. And we need to talk about it. We need to bring companies out and say, this is what you're doing. Are you proud of it? Because that's the problem. Corporate speak out of two sides of their mouth. The one, oh, we love you, we're here, we're in this together. And the other side is, don't tell us what to do, we'll inflict as much damage as we like. And we need to hold them accountable.
Okay, thank you, Sean. Paswa, good morning.
Good morning, Tlantit. You know, my issue about this government is that it perpetuates the apartheid privilege accumulated money. When you look at the mega projects that the government is announcing and say that black people are not proactive, it's basically those who have access to power and money. You know, when development comes, the bank supports the development. And if Adrian Sampier, who doesn't know have money, he can't do any development because he doesn't have the balance sheet. How do black business grow their balance sheet if the government doesn't come with the bulk infrastructure to make sure that those black companies, contractor, property developers who are black are able to develop the areas that are supposed to be developing?
Okay, thank you so much. And Dr. Soli, let's take us back to that argument around the 200 billion that was made available to businesses as some sort of relief, and of course guaranteed by the Reserve Bank. But then when you look at the criteria, it meant that only on the majority white business would benefit from that.
I think that was extremely despicable, the conduct of business. But it also said much about our government. We had argued quite significantly that, firstly, finance capital in the main, which is now the dominant of capitals in our country and perhaps even globally, had taken charge during the period of this pandemic and never made any concessions. And we had thought that, for instance, the things like a mortgage for people who were not earning income should have been suspended for both houses, for their cars. So that after the pandemic, all of us, we start afresh gradually. But they continue to behave as if everything was normal.
Yeah.
And on top of that, they were given this massive money. They didn't know how to help the informal business, or what you call even SMMEs, particularly in the townships and in rural areas. This has been quite despicable, and yet they say that there's no money, but the government was able to guarantee them with this kind of money. If money, for instance, has been rolled out proper, to start with the acceptance and of the role of the informal sector in our economy and giving them a platform to thrive. And I think worldwide, in Asia, in the Middle East, in Latin America, we've seen how the SMMEs and the informal sector have been at the core of rebuilding their economies. For instance, even this question that was raised here about mega projects, we had conceptualized that when we want to build people's houses, we needed to mobilize the people themselves to participate in the building of their own houses through the housing brigade.
Yeah.
So it's not just the government sometimes just throwing in the money, but the people get they participate in that, and they also have a sense ownership.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to go to Power News headlines quickly. When we come back, we'll be taking your calls on 0619870000, your tweet at Aldrin Sampier, hashtag Power Talk, and also you can tweet at PowerFM987. So my biggest question is this idea of you have a welfare state, and Tanti was speaking about political power instead of speaking about capitalism, but then you have this political power that they get from the votes, right, that the ballot box. But then that political power almost becomes available and up for sale to the highest bidder. It's a minute after 10:30, time for Power News Headlines.
Power Talk with Aldrin Sampier, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
So we're taking your calls on 0861-987-000, your tweets at Aldrin Sampier, hashtag Power Talk, and also you can tweet at PowerFM987. We're unpacking the implications of SA becoming a welfare state. And Tanti, the point that I wanted to raise earlier on when you were answering the question around capitalism and speaking about power. So what we realize now, even when you look at the State Capture Commission of Inquiry, that people would have voted for the ANC because of its policy proposals, yeah? But then that power is then subverted by capital, because capital is able to pay for certain things and they have a budget for it. And sometimes when we have this conversation around corruption, what I always emphasize is that people should also think about corruption in the sense of when policies are being discussed, what happens there? Is there any money that gets exchanged hands because of this person wanting to influence a policy position or even prevent a policy from going ahead because they have the money?
Absolutely, and I think this is one of the big dangers. So I think somebody just mentioned, for example, in the housing construction sector,
yeah.
And I speak here very guardedly, but you know, if you have these big developments, and I think Bama Baila also raises this issue about whether or not people can build their own houses, how they can participate in the construction sector, and if we allow, for example, big people with big ideas, and it really does speak to them, you know, the big ideas and the big projects that actually can work to the exclusion of smaller businesses that can develop within that infrastructure and that space, because where people can then use, you know, government money for big enterprise that actually undermines smaller enterprises and the opportunity for smaller enterprises to participate and to get the structures and therefore to be participating. But because they can have access, as you say, you know, to the big people and the big, you know, president and whatever it is, then it actually is that subject. It's because part of what we want in a free society is what you call free enterprise, which actually now has been subverted by really this tone of capitalism, where most of us should be able to actually, when we want to be able to start businesses, when we want to participate, its enterprise is free so that we can all participate in it's free and open to all. One of the things that happened, therefore, is that then we have big solutions, and those big solutions tend to actually subvert the participation of the smaller person. And I think in a very, very important way, it's also part of the reason why we end up with the solutions we've got. Even when we think about the economy, we think of the economy as big projects and big things rather than actually the participation and the action and effort of the individual and the smaller person where they may be, you know what I mean? So agriculture and the areas where people are, housing development projects where people are working together, whether they're working together in stock sales, to come together, to build houses, to use their own capital. So it's not big capital. It's also appropriate capital that people can raise together through their own savings to be able to, whether they're providing energy to themselves or to their neighbors or their surrounding areas, or participating in housing construction. So these are important questions in terms of what we say about big capital being able to override and take over, almost taking the role, because where sometimes you have a situation where government capital can be used actually to bring people in, it can also be subverted to actually be directed to the hands of big business and big capital to what they call, you know, I don't know, some of the words are being used. You will hear words like spreading a risk rather than managing. And so basically, you actually hand the risk sometimes to the hands of business rather than to manage it to make it lower. So those kinds of discussions are important because then they really do speak to what we think about a welfare state. And in these Scandinavian countries, one of the things that have happened, I mean, I sometimes think of the grand opportunities we have in the energy sector that would allow people, whether we're talking about biofuels, solar energy, wind, that can allow many people to participate, but we are still thinking about the big projects, big coal companies, big government coming into the energy and dealing with Eskom, because Eskom is a big, all-encompassing role, rather than actually the people's efforts themselves and how you can actually make sure that they are independent. Remember, independence can also speak to how independent you are of, you know, of a big government corporation, into actually self-dependence as a community in terms of what you can do, even to provide water. So all of these things are important, because they actually can undermine, and I think we've seen it. And that's why I think we think about, when we talk about inequality, these are the real causes of this inequality that we are facing. And that leads us then to this need for a basic income grant, because people outside of the state can do nothing. And I think those are the two important things: what the state can facilitate and what people therefore cannot do without the work of the state, even in simple things about just being able to actually earn an income. And I think one of the key areas we've seen this, and I think, and I wanted to actually touch on this important area of the informal sector.
Yeah.
That actually, when we looked at the informal sector, and I mean, I always say this, that I was one of those people who said, you know, they must not be registered, they must not be regulated, and then we could not access and give them support. What kind of ways do we think about the informal sector and the critical role the informal sector plays in our communities, in lives, and actually even actually in supporting? It's amazing also the work of the informal sector to support small, big business, because, you know, if you think about the people who are resellers of goods in our areas, so whether you think about the spaza shop that goes and sells Vodacom airtime.
Yeah.
They go and buy airtime from a big Vodacom business, and they sell that in smaller amounts to people around their communities. While we may call that informal sector, it also does play an important role in facilitating big business. What can we do to try and also bring in smaller businesses into the telecom sector, not just as resellers, but actually as producers of telecommunications products? These kinds of things are important, because actually, once we are not able to, you know, when we're sometimes where the economy was closed in the manner that it was, people therefore could not do some of this stuff, because clearly they depend on leaving their areas. They depend on leaving, you know, Soweto to go and travel to Sandton to be able to organize anything, rather than being able to organize things where people are, to be able to continue when you can say, well, we have a closed, you know, you can close people out, and actually business start to close them out of economic activity altogether. These are important considerations, because then that affects the welfare of people on a very, very direct basis.
Sure. But Mabaila, how should we then understand the role of the state in being a welfare state when you have issues like those where capital can buy power or can buy access to power, and subverting the will of and subverting the will of the people? And I was looking at the Baldwin story from yesterday, and the CEO speaks about the president calling him, and the president asking him to, you know, to speed up this project. And that's exactly what they've done, to speed up the project. But not every person has access to the president like the CEO, Steve Brooks, has. And Clanti now speaks about the informal market as well, which plays a critical role. But that informal market doesn't even have access to the minister.
Yeah, I think that's very important, the point that he has elevated on the informal sector.
Mm-hmm.
Gandhi, I think I need a discussion with him post this. You'll facilitate that, Adrian.
Yeah, okay.
Because although he doesn't want to attack the primary problem that causes our lack of development, irrespective of its dynamism, that is a capitalist system. Normally, when you have a system that is able to be so dominant that it can even buy power, you then need people's power to prevail. That is why even our democracy needs to change to delineate much more towards communities, towards people's leadership, people's authority, where they can recall at their will their own public representatives and so forth, rather than have necessarily your petty party political representatives. So when you deepen democracy in that form, people then decide even on the budgetary system. They influence even public budgets, not in the manner that it has been done in South Africa. At the moment, the way we do it is just a formalism that the municipality will say, well, we have been consulting the people, because, by the way, the law, the Municipal Systems Act, is quite clear regarding the participation of the people in the budgetary process, but it's not necessarily complied. The bureaucrats just go to the community and have a meeting and say, we're having a budget, we'll do this and that. People get excited about projects that are coming, and they come back and say, this has been endorsed. So the delineation of democracy to the communities becomes an important aspect. And I think I fully agree with the point that Grant is raising regarding even how when the people become independent, they can also become independent of government corporations. So that's how you build a strong democracy. But without a strong democracy, you are unable, therefore, to tackle capital. That's why you need a state that has got the capacity to discipline capital.
Yeah.
In our case, we have a state that has largely been weakened and is over-reliant on capital. In fact, it trusts more capital than it trusts the poor or the people in general who are the majority working class. So it's something that we need to change, both from a policy space, but also from a practical intervention of the people themselves. So they can hold both public representatives as well as the bureaucracy in government to account. At the moment, they're stuck against the people. There are many other things that, for instance, interventions that we have put on the table that have been ignored. And sometimes when they come as a business proposal, you get completely annoyed, but sometimes bemused how government officials look at them as if these are new things, when actually they've been on the table. But because they were raised by the people, they were rejected. We have done studies in Soweto about how money leads Soweto, for instance, to the inner city of Johannesburg. And we called for government to assist in the setting up of public banking. In fact, in 2000, about 60 million rand was leaving Soweto from stock firms and social clubs and savings clubs to the banks in Johannesburg. And we said to the government, facilitate a public banking capacity in the area so that these people can have confidence that they can also be bankable themselves. That's when we launched one of our major campaigns, the Financial Sector Transformation Campaign. But up to date, we're still fighting about that. But when big capitalists come with a proposal to government and say, we can create a structural bank to serve this market, then they will actually be allowed, they'll be given even good resources, supported. But when the people say so, it's not done.
Yeah.
So the change of the posture of government will require much more active participation by communities.
Okay, 0861-987-000, your tweet at Aldrin St. Pierre, hashtag Power Talk, and you can also tweet at PowerFM987. Miesha, good morning.
Aldrin, morning, how are you doing?
Good, Miesha, how are you?
Man, great show. I concur with Sean, we need more of this. Aldrin, let's just be real for a second. We can moan all we want about capital. Capital is not patriotic. Capital is brutal. Capital is ruthless. Capital, the best friend of capital is nothing but bottom line. The difference between us and other countries is our government is not the referee. In this country, capital is the player and the referee, and when it transgresses, there are no repercussions. Our government has been co-opted and has been bought through. That's why we have all these things about capital. It is uniform all over the world. Capital does that. Now, you had a fantastic show about Germany. Now, there's a question I wanted to ask. If we are saying trade between us and Germany is 350 billion, how much of that 350 billion are we making? That imbalance, who is it skewed against? That's the question that any government would ask. If I walk in the street in Bonn, in Berlin, in Frankfurt, do I see any South African product? Nothing. If I come to South Africa, South Africa looks like a mini Germany. That is the work of government to say, this is the referee. China comes, takes all our minerals. What do they bring here? Fake T-shirts, who the same political parties wear, and rubbish plastic bags. Where's that imbalance?
Yeah.
So we can blame capital for all we want. It's about us to be a strong state and say, this is where you go and not further. And when you transgress, these are the repercussions.
Thank you so much, Miesha. Owen, good morning.
Hello?
Owen Nkomo, how's it?
Good job, Bob. Uncle Eldrin. and how are you, gentlemen? Utlandi, Gunjan, Kandi, and now Mapaila. How are you, gentlemen? I'm great, gentlemen. I'm glad I caught the four of you on this session. I just wanted to say that I'm very worried and I'm very scared for our economy. You know, my concerns every day are waking up in the morning and trying to see how we can, you know, maintain the jobs that we have in our companies, and to think in the same manner for and on behalf of other entrepreneurs, and to say how are we going to continue to grow the number of people that are employed in the country. And as I sit here and I listen to Bob Mabahila, you know, talking about how there needs to be a broader involvement, including ourselves, you know, people out there, the citizenry, the people that vote, where you're saying we need to be involved in trying to solve the problems of the country. And I say, how are we poor guys like Aldrin sitting behind Lombo, Bob, Peter Sandleni, not currently writing articles and raising their views, and us guys stubbornly pushing to allocate the little capital that we get, not from government, but from our own means? How are we supposed to push an agenda if it does seem very strongly to me that people in the higher echelons of the society, Obama Mabahila leading, being in leadership for SACP and the like, are failing to talk to the government, to get the government to do the right things? Mm-hmm. How are we supposed to be able to reach that level where we can be listened to by government? And as I speak today, I couldn't sleep last night. I had major indigestion because of this Baldwin deal that was done. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you take 33 billion rands and you put it in the hands of white capital, you know, a company that is majority held by white people? PIC doesn't even hold a major stake in that company, and you've given it this deal. And we've got our brothers and sisters in construction and you know, services in the property and built environment, mm-hmm. who probably are not going to participate in this thing. And it's fine. It's let's carry on as we are.
Yeah.
How are we going to get there?
Okay, Bob Mabahila. And this was a point that was raised during the open line as well.
Well, look, I mean, I fully agree, but fundamentally that the Mweshe raised fundamental points about the attitude of political power. Political power, in fact, politics is understood from our side as concentrated economies.
Mm.
And if you have a government that doesn't understand that and believes that they must outsource economic programs to capital outside, it will not be in their interest. That is why capital make deals that makes a few individuals extra rich. But you have to ensure that there's transformation, there's inclusivity in the economy, there's mass participation, and I dare say this country has got enough resources for us to all share,
mm-hmm.
and we produce more food, but half a percent, or I mean 50% of our people are not having food security, what we call. But if you look into that space of those who have, do not even have food security, majority do not have nutritious food. So it is the ability also of the people to rise up, to power, to challenge power, whether it's the capitalist power or democratic power. But if that power is drifting away from the concept of people's power, the people themselves must rise up and bring back that power, discipline that power. Because if they borrow this power to the state, that fails to discipline those who run away with the core power, which is economic power. It doesn't help society as a whole. So I fully agree with that. I think we need different ways to do things, to hold each other accountable. Mm-hmm. We ourselves accept accountability in the Communist Party, even some of the faults that we've committed. Sometimes going along with some of our comrades, thinking that things will change and so forth. But it has reached a stage where it's just unacceptable, the level of continued underdevelopment and inequality, particularly in the rural areas, lack of basic infrastructure like water and sanitation, 25 years into democracy. It's just unacceptable. In those European countries, for example, we want to compete at the same level with them. They have long achieved these basics that we're still fighting for. That is why inward looking to transform ourselves. In fact, we've got a platform, even from a business conception, of a better economy if we were to look at doing an economy to meet our needs as a people.
Okay, Tandi?
Look, I mean, I think that, you know, everything that has been said speaks to the same thing, and they're really the big concern around the small guy. And I hate to use the small guy because obviously every individual should actually matter and actually be heard. The issue of submersion of power, and certainly the way the power dynamic works, and I think this is something that has been raised, I think, even in essence, in terms of which when, you know, the big debate around how private companies support elections and maybe find whether they fund parties or whether they fund individuals in elections of political parties. This is a critical question because obviously whenever money has been given, you know, it is usually invested rather than donated.
Yeah.
But I think that the important thing is really for citizens, especially to raise this issue sharply, because unlike what, you know, and I guess what Nkuzo Ngoma says here, that the important thing is that while the rest of us may raise the issues, it is not up to those who are analysts or commentators to actually then change the society. It is about actually raising the issues of discussions and, you know, highlighting these issues so that actually all partners of society and individuals are able to take these things forward, almost as a sharing of ideas, as what we are doing now. Yep. Whether or not this discussion goes forward is only dependent on, you know, on voters and communities and how then they hold power accountable, because the rest of us may have had this discussion, but quite differently to whether or not actually it yields any results.
Okay, just quickly before we wrap up, what's your take on the idea that when there are these levels of corruption, that it shouldn't just stop at the criminal element of it being considered that this is corruption, but also going to the core of it, that government has budgeted money to alleviate poverty and that money is being stolen or sometimes even influenced through policy, that should amount to a crime against humanity, considering, for instance, with the asbestos case, that there are people who have died from roofs that were supposed to have been taken off a long time ago.
I thought that the question around, and I thought that was really a great question, and somebody said, why should we also think about this as actually as treason, right? Because it's the highest form of actually intercepting at the role of the state and almost taking it off. One of the critical things about this, again, whether we are looking now at a symptom rather than the problem, one of the ways in which I thought about this thing was interesting during COVID-19 and the PPE. One of these, a lot of this stuff could have actually been manufactured in local factories by local people. For the sale. And what happened is that it showed how this tendering system has become so faulty, because in many instances, actually, people were tendering who have no capacity to sew or to produce, you know, face masks, and whether it's gowns that could have been given to local factories, to local groups of women to produce these things, so that actually they produce them whether for hospitals, for businesses, rather than actually ordering them on masks from China in a closed system. And one of the things that actually subverted is an idea of we want to for local development and certainly for local production and industrialization. But we're able to do it because actually the ways in which we designed this tendering system is broken, and that actually that it opens itself up to that sort of thing, rather than to say other people who are applying have the capacity, not do they. I mean, I think one of the things that I thought was interesting was an answer given by some of the accused people in terms of the corruption, who said, well, not that I have to be able to actually perform the service, but I can organize it.
Imagine.
This is a very huge problem.
Imagine.
And that actually it really undermines the idea that we want to empower people, we want to grow people, because part of that whole thing was to make sure that we can actually give productive capacity to people to be able to manufacture, and that it is not in the hands of the state.
Okay.
I think we need to think about that very much.
Bob Mabaila, your take on that?
Yeah,
in a minute, please.
We need to detenderize the state and open up the systems, particularly in the meantime, whilst we work out those details. But make sure that these tenders are open, but always ensure compliance with mass participation of the people in the space. And you'll be amazed by the level of innovation that the people will bring into that particular space, including what is generally characterized as ordinary people. I think in that way, you can spare in the efforts of all South Africans, and they will still be part of the economy, and they'll have a sense of ownership, even to protect its success.
Okay, thank you so much, Soli Mabaila, the SACP's first Deputy General Secretary, and Nkandi Bai, who is an economist. It's 11 o'clock. It's time for Power News.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.